Blues Doctor for a stir fry of funk, rock, blues, metal, and more. That's 10 a.m. every Friday on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Hi, I'm Dan Evans, and I volunteer at CFRU because it introduces me to amazing new ideas, and they're usually housed in amazing new people.
Hi, my name is Mina, and I volunteer on CFRU because I get to tell people about things that are going on in Canada that people wouldn't normally hear about.
My name is Kyle, and I volunteer at CFRU to connect with a wonderful group of diverse people.
If you would like to get involved with CFRU, contact Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or volunteer at CFRU.ca.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
We'll be right back. It's a rhythm of the sea. Lost islands of hope. It's a rhythm of the sea. Who will discover you?
Hello, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I'm Siegfried Berezov, returned after a considerable period of time, considerable absence, and it is really good to be back on air, comrades and friends. It really is. It's good to be back here. And, of course, the reason why I was away over the last few months, of course, is because I have taken part in the longest election, the longest federal election in recent Canadian history. And as disappointing as it was to be away from the radio for that period of time, I'm still glad I did it. I feel proud of what I accomplished, running for the Communist Party in the Guelph riding, and I think it was definitely worth it. Not to say that it was easy. Of course, it wasn't easy. You know, I mean, the last thing that you should think of running for the Communist Party that's an easy thing in this country. But like I said, I'm happy with the result of the election. We gained more votes than we did 4 years ago. But the important thing to remember is, with us at the Communist Party, votes are not the real reason why we run. Because we know, as Marxists and Leninists around the world know, that you cannot make a revolution through the ballot box. You have to build it in the streets. You have to build it in the factories, in the mines, in the farms, in the communities and workplaces of all kinds. Working people have to see their collective power and know what they can do when they work together for fundamental change and shape society in their own image rather than in the image of their bosses and exploiters. I ran, and almost 30 Communist Party candidates ran in this election around the country, to let the working class in Canada know that there is another way forward. A way to a future where the people are truly in charge and society exists for the benefit of those masses of people who toil to produce its wealth. You know, with our small band of comrades, we handed out more than 6,000 copies of the party platform in Guelph. We participated in every election debate and media interview that we could get. And we talked to as many people, I think, as was humanly possible for our small group to handle. It was hard. It was a struggle. We faced numerous barriers at every turn. There were panels that we were shut out of. You know, we weren't even invited to certain interviews and to certain debates. Some people didn't even, you know, basically pretended we didn't exist. But we persevered. We kept going. And I'm very proud indeed of our work. And I'm very proud to call myself a communist in Guelph. Against all odds. Against all odds, we kept the red flag flying here. And broke through with an empowering message that I think people will remember.
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. One wall ahead seemed dark as night. It witnessed many a deed and vow. One mustn't change its color now. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumph's past. It gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, the symbol plain of human rights and human gain. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live or die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. His mind's affixed on pelf and place. The cringe beneath the rich man's frown and all that sacred emblem down.
raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its foes we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying near. With heads uncovered, swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song should be our parting hymn. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Billy Bragg with the Red Flag, and I should also tell you the what I actually played right at the beginning of the show. Of course, I played Charlie Chaplin's iconic speech from The Great Dictator, which of course is the film he did in 1940. With other members of the Young Communist League here in Guelph, I actually had the pleasure of watching another one of Charlie Chaplin's greatest films just the other day, Modern Times, which he put out in 1936. And needless to say, a depiction, you know, is even in satirical terms, you know, it's a very powerful depiction of, you know, life in the 1930s, the struggles of working class people in the 1930s, and really their struggle just for survival. Yeah, for survival and respect, you know, and just for existence itself in the 1930s. You know, he's an amazing guy, you know, to make such films. And, of course, I also played Midnight Oil, their song Now or Neverland. I think that's, even though they wrote that song in particular about Australia, the same thing could be said of Canada, you know, going through this past election. An election, of course, which was scarred by considerable amounts of xenophobia, you know, of course, notably from the Harper government itself, but nonetheless also few of the other parties really had a effective response to the kind of vitriol, the racist xenophobic vitriol that the right wing was basically pouring outward in an effort to make Canadians afraid of perceived outsiders and scare them into voting for reactionary candidates. You know, there was nowhere near an effective pushback against that, you know, from the people who were running against Harper. And of course, this election really was all about stopping Harper, like for the majority of Canadians. That's like the reason, that's the main reason that people are saying that the election turnout was as high as it was. And needless to say, and we said this throughout the campaign, that simply changing the leadership, changing the face of this country, in this case, electing a majority liberal government, that's not fundamental change. That's not addressing the real problems that exist in this society. You know, whether we're talking about unemployment or we're talking about destruction of the environment, we're talking about justice for Aboriginal peoples, you know, and the national question in general, or immigration. We're fighting against racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, you know, or ensuring gender equality, or ending the security state laws and, like, you know, defending democratic rights, or ensuring that there is, that social programs are there for people, and they're expanded, and they cover everyone, and there's something people can rely on, you know, and people have jobs, decent paying jobs that will allow them to actually live and ensure a decent life for themselves and their families. You know, I was at debates in Guelph where candidates from multiple parties were more interested in basically talking about themselves and things that they had done and how great supposedly they were as people, rather than the actual policies you know, the actual issues that Canadians actually want to hear about, that actually impact their lives. You know, and this was most acute. This came out most clearly in two instances. One was a debate at the Elliott Senior Center here in Guelph. That's on Metcalf Street, just behind the Guelph General Hospital. And it also came out at a debate I went to at John F. Ross High School, which was mostly attended by high school students who couldn't even vote yet. And in both cases, the candidates really just tried to give, you know, these down-home kind of spiels about themselves and, like, talking about how, you know, in one case, like, certainly at the, you know, how they, you know, either went to that high school in the past or they still followed the sports team of John F. Ross on their Twitter account or something like that, or, you know, they are at the senior center. You know, they had a mom or a dad who was at this senior center that supposedly made them close to the folks there, or, you know, these kind of things. They would talk about how long they lived in Guelph for, or like the different kind of engagement they'd engaged in through NGOs, the Guelph Chamber of Commerce, or what have you. This is all they would talk about. I was the only one who actually even brought up the issue of healthcare and went through the Communist Party's platform on healthcare in the Elliott Senior Center. No one else brought up the topic of healthcare at all, which, needless to say, I thought was a bit bizarre. And you know, candidates were caught off guard. You know, when someone at that debate actually stood up, she was from Plowshares, which is a peace organization, and she asked the candidates about their party's support for this massive arms deal, where the Canadian government is essentially selling armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia, which of course is in the process of repressing people also, like, within Saudi Arabia and neighboring countries like Bahrain and Yemen, you know, and yearly decapitates more people than ISIS does. And yet this is a government we're supporting. They were very surprised to see an older woman actually make that argument, which says something about the stereotypes maybe they have in their head. They were also surprised, certainly the Conservative Party candidate was very much surprised, when five high school students called her out on the government's racist immigration policy during the debate at John F. Ross. And after the debate was over, actually went up on stage and actually confronted her on that particular issue. I don't think I ever saw her more uncomfortable than she was in that moment, when she was confronted by actual high school students who were demanding answers. I was very impressed by that. In fact, like, the most enthusiastic people, the most enthusiastic audience I saw at any of the debates I went to, was at John F. Ross High School. By far. Though they had the most enthusiasm, they wanted to know what everybody's platform was about. They picked up on the BS that was being fed to them by the mainstream candidates, and they really wanted to find out more about what the Communist Party and also the Marijuana Party actually stood for. They actually took us seriously, because we were taking them seriously. And frankly, it was the so-called fringe parties were the only ones who were really taking high school students seriously in this election. Which says something. You know. So, it really was an uphill battle. I mean, I actually got denied a place at a panel being run by Fair Vote Guelph, interestingly enough, seeing Fair Vote Guelph, which I like to call Unfair Vote Guelph now, apparently has an issue with, it was one of the most bizarre reasons I've ever been given for why I can't participate in an event. And in this case, they said that the Communist Party couldn't participate on this panel, which the Greens, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Conservatives had been invited to. The reason why we couldn't participate in this panel, which was supposedly on proportional representation and building fairer election systems in this country, The reason why we couldn't participate is because, according to New Zealand standards, any party that doesn't get 5% of the vote, at least 5% of the popular vote, is denied a seat under their proportional representation system. And because the Communist Party of Canada did not get 5% in the last election, it therefore could not participate in this fair vote panel, which, needless to say, didn't strike us as very fair. So we raised a bit of hell. We told the media how messed up this was. We actually went there and confronted them about this, and we got some flack. There were some anti-communist people in the audience who almost sounded like total McCarthyites the way they were talking. And it was, but we stood our ground, and that was the important thing. And I'm very happy that we did so. And that we actually were fighting for fundamental change and not just simply a change of face, which seems to be what Canada has actually gotten in the aftermath of this election. You know, so basically going forward from this, you know, I think this song, which I actually have played multiple times on this show, it's called Libere Nous des Libéraux by Loco Locas, a Quebecois band. And originally, of course, it was a protest song directed against the provincial Liberals, who were, of course, the target of the Quebec student strike, you know, a few years back. Now I think it actually takes on a whole new meaning because, of course, in many cases, I think Canadians are going to find out just what they actually voted for and see how little, in fact, has changed with the Liberals in charge. You know, and they're going to be starting to ask, very, very soon for people to liberate them from the Liberals and for real fundamental change in this country. So, without further ado, I'm going to play that song. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Deux grandes traditions qui, malheureusement, ont marqué trop d'années de l'histoire de la province de Québec. Premièrement, le mépris le plus complet pour l'intelligence du citoyen qu'on considère comme une simple marchandise électorale. Et deuxièmement, la servilité d'un parti de rois nègres qui sont en fait les valets de chambre de certains gros intérêts, surtout les plus rapaces, qui eux aussi méprisent la population comme une espèce de tribu arriérée qui est faite pour être exploitée à loisir.
Au tour maintenant du chef du Parti libéral du Québec, M. Jean Charest.
Merci mon pète. Je suis prêt. L'équipe libérale est prête. Nous sommes prêts. Prêt pour prêt, la charrue, charrée, acharnée, char, tout en charpie, la charpente de la maison qu'on a mis 40 ans à bâtir. Un photo que militer pour Amir Kadir. Maintenant la table est mise pour 4 ans à partir. À pâlir à vue d'œil ahuri à la vue. De la bande d'abrutés qui bras d'abri d'abattus. Qui vendent à rabais par la bande. Que pas de prix, une bonne main de finir payer sans d'un abatti. Coupe sombre, coupe en blanc, coupe gris.
Alouette, je t'ai plus marré.
Puis pour couper coro, coro populaire. Bah ta bouffe étouffe, la foule est légifère. À tombeau ouvert, puis tout sourire ça, la soupe populaire.
C'est ça être solidaire quand on a sacré tout à terre.
Afin de faire taire, un argumentaire, une écantaire. L'Amérique fait son affaire, ça fait bien trop l'affaire. Des régents d'affaires, du Canada, puis du conseil du patronat. Baillon, bah baillon, je raille pareil, le patron des patrons.
Ta gueule, taillon.
Si le démat, démat, tellement, t'excite tellement que c'est comme de la musique à tes oreilles. Comment t'aimes le tête à mort des barbares? Dans tes tympans d'avoir à gare.
Face à la menace de la braderie, on brandit le poing de la patrie à la face des bandits. Face à la menace de la braderie, on brandit le poing.
L'épée crie nous des libéraux.
Libérez nous des libéraux. Libérez nous des libéraux. Libérez nous des libéraux. Libérez nous des libéraux. Libérez nous des libéraux. Libérez nous des libéraux.
J'te dis carré catégorique, j'en chaurais. Mike Harris, même combat. Même charisme, même carnesse. Des biens et services publics en lice. Faut que ça finisse la chasse au PS. Pour eux, c'est une business inespéré. Puis ceux qui dépérissent, il reste plus qu'à prier. Saint-Jean-Baptiste, ça s'apprendra ma race de séparatistes. Y a pas de place, on peut pas faire la pièce. Contrat de performance pour la SGF. Pour les CPE,
pour les SDF.
Hey, un impôt sur la quête. Ça serait pas bête. Ça dirige le Québec comme une PME. Comme un pimp, c'est put pour que la ligne les PIPES. Ça c'est, ça se connaît. La clé du succès pour le 24 succès, c'est d'asexuel Québec. Quel beau sujet pour Jean-Claude Lavrecque. À hauteur de gnon,
hauteur de braguette.
Sucer debout, c'est ça, se tenir drette.
Je suis prêt.
On est loin de maître chez nous. Maintenant comme jamais, y'a un traître chez nous. Ça s'entend quand il parle comme un derrière de boîte de céréales. Si tu penses me faire taire, tu fais à ton âge d'intarissable. Je vais sous ton ciel, musée, je suis ton féal.
Face à la menace de la braderie, on brandit le poing de la patrie à la face des bandits. Face à la menace de la braderie, on brandit le poing.
Libérez-nous des libéraux.
Libérez
de sources qui nous distingue. Au carnaval libéral fédéral, ça bringue dingo. Viva Canada, banana de mon méga.
Banda sur mode, on est d'accord là.
Un parti unique, c'est un parti inique, ciné, kiné. Tout débat démocratique, la confiance de la rue est rompue. Car la cour de l'empereur corrompu accumule les écus. Et enfin, quand il s'en a faim, le monarque débarque. Mais passe le pouvoir à son homme de main comme un bon roi
chrétien.
Mais selon moi,
Martin
tient du requin. Du dauphin, l'armateur, arnaqueur, anglo-franco, c'est plus trop, joue sur tous les tableaux. C'est l'homme des chaleurs, mais des salamalecs.
Mais comment croyez-vous qu'ils conçoivent le Québec?
De tout ça, véritable sous-marin, soi-disant nous dans la même émate, nous dématé, embarquant le gros paquebot des fédéraux dans nos eaux. C'est sûr, ça s'énue comme la moelle dans nos eaux. En somme, ça me semble simple sous les libéraux. Québec et Ottawa sont les lames de ciseaux. L'une décrisse les racines du lycée, l'autre s'immisce au sein de nos services.
Ça fait qu'émasculer, puis enculer, le calculer, pas compliqué, on va reculer.
Devant un tas d'unifoliés déployés à tous les paliers, croyez qu'on va tous se noyer, croyez dans la marée rouge, à moins qu'on ne bouge. Oh, ouais, bouge!
J'ai tous les libéraux, libérez tous les libéraux, libérez tous les libéraux. Oh,
ouais, bouge!
J'ai tous les libéraux, libérez tous les libéraux, libérez tous les libéraux.
L'école bleue, l'école blanche, toutes les écoles confondues, on tue dans la rue. Printemps comme une crue, t'as éclaté notre alcool, une débâcle de contrôle.
Président directeur général du Canada. Je suis heureux de constater que les cocos cocasses s'intéressent au Parti libéral. Et j'y suis libéral, j'y suis libéral.
Dame des lits de libérer, libérer. Dame des lits de libérer, nous libéraux. Dame des lits de libérer, libérer. Dame des lits de libérer, nous libéraux. Dame des lits de libérer, libérer. Dame des lits de libérer, nous libéraux. Dame des lits de libérer, libérer.
What's up? This is Teaspoon from Delhi to Dublin, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objet d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
It is no surprise that one of CFRU's longest-running and most popular programs is Clan na Gael. We feature 2 hours of the best Celtic music from around the world and around the corner. Listen on Sundays after the BBC World News at noon. Tune in and get your fill of fiddles, whistles, banjos, mandolins, bowrons, harps, flutes and wonderful voices. And of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite Celtic musical instrument, the bagpipes. Clan na Gael is the most bagpipe-friendly show on CFRU FM 93.3. Join me, John Fahey, on Sundays and start your own Celtic Kitchen Ceilidh.
The Guelph Food Bank is looking for volunteers to help out throughout the year with various events and food drives. As a volunteer, you can help out with the warehouse, stuff a vehicle events, Christmas gift wrapping at the mall, and much, much more. The Guelph Food Bank is located at 100 Crimea Street in Guelph, a physically accessible location. For more information, contact Tracy at 519 767-1380.
Okay, you listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So just before the break, of course, we heard Loco Locas with Libere Nous de Libero. And, I mean, like I said before, I mean, there's a lot of hype right now. I mean, certainly when I was actually seeing the election results announced as of Monday and the election finally ended, there wasn't a whole hell of a lot of enthusiasm in the room where I was at, which was at the Albion Hotel in downtown Guelph, about the Liberal majority government. I'm assuming there was considerable enthusiasm over the E-Bar, where, of course, like apparently the Liberals had congregated. But it just seems in general there's not really a whole hell of a lot of, enthusiasm for the election results. I mean, everybody's glad that Harper's gone, and that's about it. I mean, true enough. I mean, if you actually look at the concrete things, which, of course, the Liberals actually have in their platform, they have a lot of things which are very unlikely to implement, such as they promised a lot about changing the electoral system. You know, changing the electoral system, actually getting proportional representation in. But, of course, how likely is that to happen, given they just won a majority, a pretty substantial majority, too, under the old system? What incentive do they really have to change it? And seeing they're one of the two main parties that's basically run this country since Confederation. You know, they really are the old guard. And many people are now very cynical about any change on that front coming from them. Probably the most troubling thing, and of course I've talked about austerity and the austerity measures which get put in place in countries around the world as the capitalist system really cuts back on the concessions that it made to the working class during the Cold War years in the 20th century. And increasingly, workers are put in a very precarious position where, you know, all of a sudden they don't have any job security. They don't have the kind of benefits that they used to have. They don't have the upward mobility that they used to have. They don't have any of the things that they used to be able to take for granted in these supposedly affluent Western countries, such as Canada. And, you know, that's the case in Canada as well. Like, one of the things we talked about in this country was the need to build full-time, well-paid, permanent jobs. You know, the Communist Party was talking about this. And the way to do that, of course, was to actually publicly invest in building Canadian manufacturing. You know, public direct investment in that. And rebuilding Canadian infrastructure. You know, public infrastructure, rebuilding public infrastructure that's actually going to benefit Canadians. And also, build and expand public services. And public services account for many things. These are not just like things like healthcare or education. These are things also like women's shelters, you know, and, you know, crisis centers, transition houses, all these kind of things. All these kind of services which have been defunded, cut back, slashed to the bone by both Liberal and Conservative governments since the early 90s. And you have to remember that a lot of the cutbacks in funding to the provinces, you know, certainly with regard to healthcare and education and things like that, and social housing, which was basically eliminated, the funding for that, happened under the Liberals in the 1990s. You know, under the Chrétien government back then, when Paul Martin was serving as finance minister. So, I mean, that's something really to keep in mind here about who the kind of people that the government which has just come in and the party which has just come in really serves. I mean, their idea of a stimulus, apparently, which, you know, was a big thing. I mean, they tried to run to the left of the NDP, and the NDP made that actually rather easy because the NDP under Tom Mulcair really dropped the ball and basically ran from the right and tried to act like they were economically conservative. You know, and I guess they were trying to take votes from the conservatives that way. Needless to say, that whole strategy backfired. But the Liberals basically said, oh, yeah, we will run a budget deficit and we will make all the spending that, we will spend to, like, you know, basically improve the Canadian economy and all this sort of stuff. But, of course, if you actually see how bailouts actually work in practice, and this is the case in the United States, in Canada, in Western Europe, following the 2008 financial crash, who gets bailed out? I think we all know the answer to that. This is public money being used to basically bribe the private sector, to shore up the public sector, to build up the private sector, I should say. This is, yeah, public money, taxpayer money going to the private sector, to the capitalist class, basically, the people who actually own and control the means of production in society. You know, public money goes to further their interests, their profits. And I've seen no indication that Justin Trudeau's stimulus plan is anything different from that. And the kind of infrastructure he's planning on spending on. You know, if past bailouts are any indication, will be the infrastructure that private business can use and profit from. Not what the public needs. Not what is in the public interest. And this is the important thing. You have to look beyond the rhetoric in all these situations. In like elections, it doesn't matter if it's an election or if it's just, you know, at any time. You always have to look, you have to look behind, you have to do the research, you have to like see what's really going on and whose interests are really being served by government policies. Because certainly I don't think austerity policies in this country are going to end anytime soon under the new Liberal government. You know, and it's the same thing with things like the national question when it comes to justice for Aboriginal peoples. I mean, he said he's going to like put an investigation into missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Of course, that is something that has to be done. It's the bare minimum, frankly, that needs to be done. One hell of a lot more things have to be done than that. You know, it needs to go beyond that. It needs to be implementing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommendations with regard to residential schools. But one of the things that was never talked about by any of the other parties in this election is, frankly, the need to build a Canada based on equality among nations and real respect for self-determination. We really need to put the final nail in the coffin of colonialism in this country. And the only thing that's really going to do that, you know, besides, of course, like the building of a socialist society, you know, what we need is a democratic constitution based on equal and voluntary partnership of the Aboriginal peoples, Quebec, the Acadians, and English-speaking Canada that recognizes the right of nations to self-determination up to and including the right to secede, to secession. That doesn't mean we're encouraging secession. But just as in the case of divorce, you know, just in the case with marriages, both parties to a marriage have to have the right to divorce, to end the relationship, if the relationship is going to be considered equal. And it's the same thing with regard to nations. They have to have the right to secede. They have the right to leave. And that's the only way you have an equal partnership of nations within the society. There was a lot of talk about building a new relationship between the federal government and First Nations people based on nation-to-nation basis. I mean, really besides the Communist Party position on that, the other parties' positions were very, very, very vague. And they really sounded like just a bunch of happy talk. There didn't seem like there was that much substance to them at all. And needless to say, if there's anybody who is used to all kinds of fancy promises being made to them and then being betrayed, that's the Aboriginal peoples of this country. You know, and I would like to think that there is going to be real change on that front. But needless to say, with regard to the Liberals, I am very skeptical. Now, because of course, just like the Conservatives, the Liberal Party has traditionally been the party of colonialism in this country, and has also perpetuated imperialism abroad. You know, so I think this is really the time. I'm going to play a couple of clips from Michael Parenti right about now. The first one does address imperialism, unpacking it in a very brief way, as Michael Parenti is very good at doing. And the second one is the interview, which Michael Parenti gave earlier this year about austerity. You know, what it is, what it means. You know, its impact on societies around the world, on working people, and why it is that we need to oppose it. Because really, brothers and sisters, the fight has just begun. The real battle is not during elections. You know, frankly, it's not in Parliament at all. The real fight is not in Parliament. The real fight is on the streets, it's in the workplaces, it's in the communities, it's ongoing, it's at the grassroots. It's really organizing people for real fundamental change. That's where real change happens. And we have to keep that in mind, and we have to keep struggling for all the change that needs to be made in this country, and there's a lot of it. Because certainly the Liberal Party is not going to do it. So very important to understand. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes. First enunciated very well in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they can be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking human beings. And the wagons form their circle, and the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest. As they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers, this is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that, and then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium. calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, a million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
Okay. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California. And we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Prophet Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello. How are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity?
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people of scarcity and hardship. And that's done by those at the top who work us and work us,
and who
have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty, when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation of by wealth. I mean, slaves were wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners. Wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. That's one of the points one has to make. Well, what was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term, like, all the time these days, like, about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see, like, really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity. You know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich. It's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, and it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities. an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the Depression. But that war got people out of the Depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a job on the side, and, mm-hmm. or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down, and there was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education. These things that they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise. Which we had to, keep up with the Reds. Here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West. And that's when the mythology also emerged that America's the land of prosperity. And for whatever prosperity, they really advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America everybody's got a car now and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these superhighways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was, enough is enough, we've got to roll this back. And they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great, prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah, so of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right, austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, and right up until the late part of the 20th century. 19, as I say, the 80s or so is a turnaround.